comes my way, particularly when temptation to sin, to sins that I may not think are a big deal, ones that I think nobody will know about, nobody will get hurt by. Solomon's horses is what I remind myself of. Let me just watch this movie. The family's gone. It's not going to hurt anyone. I know there's some things in it that I probably should be guarding my eyes from. Solomon's horses. That's mine. I'm just protecting what belongs to me. What's the big deal? Solomon's horses. Man, that just ticks me off. I am so frustrated by that, but I don't deal with it the way I should. Okay, Solomon's horses. Okay, Solomon's horses. Just keep remembering that, Travis. The same thing happens to us, can happen to the church too. When we begin to make these small little concessions on matters that may not seem like a big deal. Maybe it's books that we promote. Maybe it's events we host. Who is allowed to do what? May not seem like a big deal by itself. But many times it leads to more and more things. And before we know it, we're at a place that we did not plan on being when we allowed that first little thing to happen. We can't take one thing where we know the Bible teaches on a subject and reason amongst ourselves as saying, meh, it's not that big a deal. All the churches in town are doing it. Why can't we? Why? Solomon's horses, that's why. If you've got your place, 1 Kings chapter 11, if you want to stand, we'll read through verses 1 through 8. This is our main text this morning. We're going to be going to a couple other different places as we kind of bring in some more context to what we read about Solomon in this passage in 1 Kings. But 1 Kings 11, and starting in verse 1, it says, "Now King Solomon loved many foreign women along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the sons of Israel, 'You shall not associate with them, nor shall they associate with you, for they will surely turn your heart away after other gods.' Solomon held fast to these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, 300 concubines, and his wives turned his heart away. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the detestable idol of the Ammonites. Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not follow the Lord fully as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable idol of Moab, on the mountain which is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the detestable idol of the sons of Ammon. Thus also he did for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods." Father, thank you for the opportunity just to come and look at your word as we look at what can happen if we make small concessions to things that we know are sinful and what that could lead to, Lord. And Lord, you've given us a really good example here this morning of just being on guard, to guard our hearts against even things that we don't think are a big deal. Father, just pray that you be with us the next few moments as we look into your word, and may it speak clearly to us. We'll ask these things in your son's name. Amen. Thank you. Be seated. How did it come to this? How did Solomon go from this man of great wisdom and instruction to what we just read? When you read a couple of the books that he wrote, Ecclesiastes and Proverbs, it's apparent that he wondered the same thing many times in his life. How did it come to this? I'm going to read through a couple other passages this morning. You're welcome to turn there with me. We'll ultimately be coming back to 1 Kings, but in 2 Chronicles chapter 9, we get a little more backstory on Solomon himself. 2 Chronicles 9, verse 22, we read, "So King Solomon had become greater than all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom, and all the kings of the earth were seeking the presence of Solomon to hear the wisdom which God had put in his heart. They brought every man his gift, articles of silver and gold, garments, weapons, spices, horses and mules, so much year by year. Now Solomon had 4,000 stalls for horses and chariots and 12,000 horsemen, and he stationed them in the chariot cities and with the king in Jerusalem. He was ruler over all the kings from the Euphrates River, even to the land of the Philistines, and as far as the border of Egypt. The king made silver as common as stones in Jerusalem, and he made cedars as plentiful as sycamore trees that are in the lower land. And they were bringing horses for Solomon from Egypt and from all countries. It's about a man that pretty much had it all. Okay? Solomon, materially speaking, did not have a single need in the world. He literally was the wealthiest man to ever live and walk on the face of the earth. Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, peasants in comparison to Solomon. Solomon was born into wealth, and he achieved even greater fortune on his own. You know the story. God gave him a choice. What do you want? And Solomon said, I want wisdom. And God was so pleased with that answer that not only did he give Solomon wisdom, but he went on to give him all the other stuff that he didn't ask for. And in 1 Kings 10, verse 14, we read that Solomon had received in a single year 666 talents of gold. Now, some commentaries say that he'd receive that each year. There are some more conservative approaches that say, well, maybe he received that. That was the extent of everything that he had received. But even if it's just for a single year, if that was everything that he ever received, it's a lot. 666 talents of just the gold. Remember that. One talent is equal to 75 pounds. And maybe some of you are trying to do the math there. But one talent, 75 pounds, meaning that one talent is equal to 1,200 ounces. 666 talents then are equal to 799,200 ounces of gold. As of this past week on the commodities market, gold was selling for about $1,500 an ounce. So in today's dollars, that would equal $1,198,800,000, and that's just the gold. Because you got to remember, 2 Chronicles tells us that he made silver as common as stones. He had a wonderful import-export business with the sycamores and the cedars and all the wood and everything. Wonderful, wonderful businessman he was as well. And then we come to verse 28, though, and we read where his horses were coming from, and it says, and they were bringing horses for Solomon from Egypt and from all the other countries. And you think, yeah, so what? What's the big deal? What's the big deal about a little sin no one's going to really know much about? Is it even really a sin? We go through this temptation many times ourselves, I think, in a given week. Some of you are probably going to face that today. I may face that today. If no one's going to know, if no one's going to get hurt by it, is it really a sin? What's the big deal about the church allowing fill in the blank? What's the big deal if I do this, fill in the blank? I think of growing up and mom and dad telling me not to do something, you know, as parents will instruct us, as Shannon and I, as parents ourselves now, are instructing our children. Mom and dad would tell me this one particular thing, don't do this. And as a young, immature, stupid kid, I'd sit back and go, whatever. What's the big deal? Who's that going to hurt? And it wasn't until many years later that now that I have my own boys and I'm telling them those same things, now they're looking back on me and now I understand that the look that my mom and dad would have seen. When Clay's, he'll knowingly tell us maybe that his favorite driver finished second in a race, when that's not necessarily true. What's the big deal? Even for us as parents, we're tempted to think, who cares? But when he knowingly says something that he knows is not true, we've got to put a stop to that. Because even though it's so small right there in that moment, that smallness of that little sin will take root and it will grow and grow until later in life it becomes something that he's going to struggle with. Therefore, we've got to stop things that before they come to that. So we as parents, we give this instruction. Why do we do that? Because we know what's best. At least we do it to our best ability for our children. We make these decisions because we know what's best for them. And God does the same thing with us. So what's the big deal about a few horses from Egypt? Well, if you want to, you can turn with me back to Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, and in verse 14, we begin to read some instruction here by the Lord and how Israel was to set themselves up structurally. When you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the other nations who are around me. You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your countrymen you shall set as king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman. Moreover, now listen to this, moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return that way. And it goes on in verse 17, he shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away, nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. So in verse 16 there, you shall not multiply horses, nor shall you cause people to return to Egypt to bring them back. God's command is very clear. Very clear in his instruction there. But let's be honest. With God's commands, sometimes even things that we know God clearly says is wrong, sometimes we don't agree, right? Sometimes we try to reason among ourselves many times of saying, still, what's the big deal? In this case here, it's like, come on, God, they're just horses. Why did God not want Israel's kings to import these types of horses? They're considered war horses. Armored war horses and chariots in this time would have been very much in comparison with what today's tanks would be like, both of which very devastating to when fighting foot soldiers. Foot soldiers don't stand a chance against tanks. Same with the armored horses and the chariots that they possessed in this time. Foot soldiers didn't stand much of a chance against them either. So a nation with this level of war material, who do you think they'd start to put their reliance in? They'd start to put their reliance in the fighting machine. Why should we trust an invisible God when we can look at all this? Look at all this power that we possess. Look at all this, these horses and these chariots and everything that we possess. And maybe some say, Solomon just didn't know. Solomon just didn't know that he wasn't to have these horses. Maybe his dad, David, didn't tell him these things. Maybe his dad never taught him these things. And there's so much wrong with that statement that relates to Solomon. Number one, Solomon he's labeled as the wisest man to have ever lived. Are we really going to believe that he didn't know? You don't need to turn to these passages, but if you allow me to, in Psalm 20, verse 7, we read, some boast in chariots and some in horses, but we will boast in the name of the Lord our God. Who wants to guess who wrote that psalm? David, Solomon's daddy, okay? David wrote this. So the reasoning continues. Maybe David was just a bum dad and didn't teach his son Solomon, right? Sorry, we can't claim that either. Because in 1 Kings, we read of an account where David's as David is nearing death, it says, as David's time drew near to die, he charged Solomon, his son, saying, I'm going the way of the earth. Be strong, therefore. Show yourself a man. Keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments. Remember the commandments from Deuteronomy. His ordinances and his testimonies, according to what is written in the law of Moses, that you may succeed in all that you do and wherever you turn, so that the Lord may carry out his promise, which he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons are careful of their way, to walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. Now see, David taught his son. We know that. So not only was Solomon wise, so we can't claim that he didn't know. We can't claim that David wasn't a good father and didn't teach him. We know that he did. All right, well, maybe David, or maybe Solomon, I mean, just forgot. Maybe he was having a bad day. Can't really claim that either, because back in Deuteronomy, if you still happen to be there, right after where we just left off, we've got this command of don't go after the horses, don't multiply your wives, don't do these things. And then the very next verse, in verses 18 through 20, it says, now it shall come about when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of this law on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priests. It shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up against his countrymen, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or to the left, so that he and his sons may continue long in the kingdom in the midst of Israel. So you see, each king that was established as king over Israel, one of the things that they had to do is they had to write the law down themselves. They had to write the commandments down in the presence of the Levitical priests, and then they had to daily recite that. So this would have been something very much in his memory banks. It would have been remembered there with the wisdom he possessed. He would have had that. He can't claim ignorance to this. So I'm reminded many times of when we sin in ignorance, when a person comes alongside us and wants to help us, and they point out, see what I'm seeing in your life, here's where we see the teaching on that. Now you know. So you can't claim ignorance to things. Well, maybe he just did this and it was really nothing more than lip service to him. All these things up to this point, he wrote down the law, presence of the Levitical priests, he went daily and recited this, and maybe he was just giving lip service. Well, in Proverbs 21, verse 31, who do you think wrote that? The very man we're talking about, Solomon. In Proverbs 21, verse 31, here's what Solomon himself says. The horse is prepared for the day of battle, but the victory belongs to the Lord. Now, Solomon very much knew that he was not to do these things. Solomon very much knew that multiplying horses, going back to Egypt to get those and to accept them as gifts, he knew that was wrong. So we come back to our text in 1 Kings chapter 11, where we start to see then, now with all that backdrop, we start to see how one little sin has this compounding effect on a person. Compounding his compromise concerning war horses, by the end of his reign, Solomon had established quite the harem. Something also commanded to stay away from in the Deuteronomy passage. It said there that he shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away. And then look at what happened in verse 4 of our text, in 1 Kings. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods. The very thing that was promised, if you do this, this is what will happen. The very thing that was promised is exactly what happened. And it didn't end there. In verses 5 through 11, it goes on. And it just becomes more of a wreck for him. For Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the detestable idol of the Ammonites. Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not follow the Lord fully, as David and his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable idol of Moab, in the mountain which is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the detestable idol of the sons of Ammon. Thus also he did for his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed. Do you think Solomon had planned for this? Do you think when the very first day, that very first horse that came out, he said, no, do you think he would have chose this result, this ending? I doubt it, okay? I doubt it. Think of your own lives when you have given in to something and it has escalated to the point that now you're in deep. Did you ever plan to be in the deep? No, because it all started way back here when you made that first little concession. Chemosh, Scripture records that Chemosh demanded human sacrifice. Do you think that Solomon growing up would have said, you know what, when I'm king, I'm gonna do human sacrifices? No. In the days of Judah's king, Jehoram, the king of Moab faced military defeat, and the Moabite ruler took his firstborn son, who was to succeed him as king, and offered him as a sacrifice on the city wall. Molech. I know some of my Bible scholars out there know all good and well about Molech. Leviticus 20, you don't need to turn there, but let me just read some things about Molech. In Leviticus 20, you shall also say to the sons of Israel, any man that is from the sons of Israel or from the alien sojourning in Israel who gives any of his offspring to Molech shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. I will also set my face against that man and will cut him off from among the people because he has given some of the offspring to Molech so as to defile the sanctuary and to profane my holy name. If the people of the land, however, should ever disregard that man that he gives any of his offspring to Molech so as to not put him to death, then I myself will set my face against that man and against his family, and I will cut him off from among the people, both him and all of those that play the harlot after him, by playing the harlot after Molech. Molech worship was practiced by the Ammonites and the Canaanites. You can go home and you can even Google, artistic images of what the god of Molech was resembled by. Many times a huge bronze sculpture with arms stretched out like this, under which a fire was lit, and that the flames would come up and heat up those arms to where then they would bring the infants and set them on the arms to be burned to death. Some sources would indicate that the child would also pass through the fire before being placed onto the arms of Molech. That was done in a way to them to baptize or to purify the child, so it was a holy sacrifice to Molech. So the horrors of abortion and child sacrifice are nothing new. Solomon's horses. We need to be reminded of Solomon's horses when we make simple concessions. But it was just horses, though, right? What is the big deal about horses? Perhaps Solomon's reasoning went something like this. When I imported the horses from Egypt, there were no immediate consequences. Okay, I didn't face a chastisement, or I didn't face a punishment quickly. That never came. And since there was no adverse consequences here, what's wrong with taking a few extra wives for political purposes? Because that's what he did. You notice the wives that he took in were from other countries, and he used those for some political gain. We know that at some point Solomon definitely would have learned this principle because he writes about it later on in Ecclesiastes chapter 8 where he says, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men are fully set in them to do evil. I'll read that one more time. Because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the hearts of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. And how often have we thought through things like that? We test God a little bit. And when punishment doesn't come right away, we allow ourselves to reason that same way. Okay, God didn't punish me in the way that I thought he would have here. Therefore, he must be okay with it. So we begin to make these little concessions until one day, that day comes that we find ourselves we're so deep and so much in trouble that backing out becomes really difficult. Backing out, it becomes almost humanly impossible without a great deal of pain and a great deal of hurt to those maybe around us. Could be in our families. Husbands, maybe you're addicted to something that you look at on the computer that maybe you shouldn't be. And you've allowed yourself and your mind and your process up there to be so now entrenched with that, to come out of that is going to rip a family apart because of what you've allowed it to come to. If you have worked or ever worked in the business or manufacturing world, you may be familiar with something that's called Six Sigma training. I've become that. I've kind of started down that path myself at work. And one of the things that we learn how to do is how to find the root cause of a problem. We employ a method, it's called the five whys. A very basic example kind of looks something like this. One of the monuments in Washington, D.C. is deteriorating. Okay, which kind of begs the first question, why? Why is the monument deteriorating? Well, it's because the harsh chemicals that are frequently used to clean the monument are deteriorating the monument. Okay, we've got our answer, right? Let's stop using the harsh chemicals. And yet, if we were to stop right there, it wouldn't ever fix our problem. We've got to keep digging a little bit further. Okay, well, why are harsh chemicals being used? To clean off the large number of bird droppings that are on the monument. Okay, next question, why? Why are we seeing this on the monument? Well, because there's a large population of spiders in and around the monument as the food source to the local birds. Why is there a large population of spiders? Because vast swarms of insects on which spiders feed are drawn to the monument at dusk. Okay. Well, why are we seeing swarms of insects? Now that's the fifth why. So now we've kind of asked the five whys. We're starting to get to the heart of the problem here. And the answer to the fifth why are we seeing large swarms of insects? Because the lighting on the monument at evening attracts the local insects. So now do you see, if we would have stopped after the first why kind of says, oh, okay, well, let's stop using the chemicals. We wouldn't have fixed the problem. But now that we start to see that all this is stemming from these insects coming in because of the lights that we set on the monument, maybe we need to change our lighting pattern. Get rid of the insects, and then it feeds back up to where now all of a sudden we've solved the problem. This is why many people, in my opinion, get entrapped in a sin. When we see that happen, we have to help them get to the root of the problem rather than simply helping them address the symptoms of the problem. For example, I knew a man that once told me of his addiction to immoral behavior. Some of the counsel that he had received was, one of his daily routines, his practice was, is he would drive by this one gas station, and he knew there was a certain kind of magazine on the rack in there. He'd drive by that gas station, and he'd stop. So some of the counsel that he received was, go a different way home. But the root of the problem was never dealt with. So even though his path changed, he just found another gas station to stop at. See, the root cause of lust was never dealt with in the man's life. And he continued to struggle with this until we started to get at the heart of what was causing this in his life. So if the root causes of the problem are not dealt with, then problems will only intensify. When Israel invaded the promised land, God told them not to allow any of the enemy to remain. But the Bible records for us that Joshua spared giants in three different cities, Gaza, Ashdod, and Gath. So again, we kind of are tempted to ask, what's the big deal? He spared life. Isn't that the right thing to do? Well, later we learn in the Bible that Samson got in trouble in Gaza. We learn that the ark of God's glory was lost in Ashdod. And then we also then finally learn that Goliath paralyzed troops in Israel in Gath. None of these tragedies may have occurred had the giants that had been left in Israel would have been done away with as Joshua was told to do. Through following God's instructions, we must eliminate the spiritual giants of sin. Okay, we can't allow those things that you may seem to think that they're small, but they're big. Okay, so we have to eliminate the giants like what God told Joshua to do. Cut those giants down in your life. Get drastic if you have to. From the minor infractions of importing horses, Solomon eventually condoned and was at the very least, an accessory then to the sins of idolatry and outright murder. From horses to the murder of children. Sins that he would never have ever thought about condoning from the beginning. Yet here he was. He's in a pickle. All because of some silly horses. Wise Solomon, he fell victim to the same temptations that the rest of us do and that the rest of us so often face. He compromised on what he thought were small things, matters that he probably considered well into the gray areas. The danger of such reasoning, though, is when we do that, we make small compromises like that, and it weakens our character. And over time, it leads to major sins. For Solomon, the results were devastating. His experience is a warning that should befall us, that if we are to follow his example of compromise. But it's still just the Old Testament, right? And if you're thinking about things, you're not alone. I did too. Maybe that just proves, though, that there are some sins in your life that maybe you're thinking about now. Maybe there's some things right now that's just going through your head, and you're thinking, I still don't see the big deal. What's the big deal in doing this? And that wrestling match has begun with the dangers with those. Maybe you're trying to reason among yourselves to find a way to accept them. I've done that often. And it comes back to just simple things. It's not going to hurt anyone. No one's going to know about it. So the danger of flawed reasoning, though, can you allow me just for a moment, because I like to talk about this stuff, to bore you to death with a lesson in logic? I'm going to do it anyway, but...
So we should be saying yes.
Yes. Yes, okay, good. Thank you. All right. Now, as I get started, though, I will understand that if I look up and you're all sitting there going, what? Okay, I got that. See, there's a logical fallacy that's called affirming the consequent. It's a type of non sequitur. Okay, what's meant by that? It's kind of a head scratcher. It's like going, that sounds good, but it just doesn't seem to follow. It doesn't seem to make much sense there. That's kind of what we're talking about here. You know, it sounds good on the surface, but it's just kind of got you going, gosh, it doesn't pass the smell test. I don't know what's off here. But listen to the difference, if you will, from a biblical standpoint. John 9 says this. John 9, as he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he should be born blind? Do you hear the disciples committing the fallacy? Okay, he does. They do. The argument that the disciples, if we were to put it in logical form, would say something like this. If you sin, you will be born blind. He was born blind, therefore he sinned. Okay, that's called affirming the consequent. And it's a logically invalid argument. Now listen to the difference here. In James 1, verse 15, we read, Then, when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Now, putting that into logical form, it says, if you sin, it will lead to more sin and consequences. You have sinned, is the second premise. Then the conclusion, therefore, it will lead to more sin and consequence. And this is what's called affirming the antecedent. And it's considered a logical, valid argument. And this is exactly what was happening to Solomon. And this is exactly what Solomon had experienced. One sin that led to another, that led to another, that led to another, until now he's so deep in this. And I think as you read through the book of Ecclesiastes, you start to see the heartache and everything that he expresses that came from some of those poor choices that he made. So my warning to you this morning on an individual level is just simply this. Don't fool yourself into thinking that God is okay with that little sin that you've convinced yourself it's small. He's not. Whatever you're holding on to, I would challenge you just to beg God for forgiveness, repent, turn from that, and ask him to give you some victory in whatever that is in your life. We've seen perfect example here of horses. Simple horses, big deal. And look what it led to. Immediately the snake bit her, and as the poison shot through her body, she cried out, "Why did you bite me? You promised to be my friend." And as the rattlesnake slithered away, he turned with a smirk and he said, "You knew what I was when you picked me up." And so it is with every sin that we think we can handle and get away with. You knew what it was before you even picked it up and the dangers that can come with it. Father, thank you for the opportunity to share your word.